For today's show, we are speaking truth to power about the overt racism in the NFL, Vancouver's current political prisoner, and the Yellow Vest movement in France. But before we get to all that, I would like to acknowledge that the lands on which we gather are the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. And rather than keeping this as a tokenistic gesture to the Indigenous people of Canada, as is generally done on UBC's campus, we will keep the Indigenous struggle for self-determination and justice at the forefront of our consciousness. We will begin this show and every show until there's justice for Indigenous people talking about colonialism. So, building off of our long discussion about colonialism, colonialism is so pervasive in our society and that we take, and if you've ever doubted about how deep settler colonialism and that racism towards Indigenous people is in our society, well, just take a quick look at the NFL, because of one of 32 teams, they clearly couldn't think of enough names, and they ran with a racial slur as one of the names. So the Washington R-Words, they currently have a racial slur as their team mascot. So I'll just share this opinion piece from last month by Jefferson Keel. He put this in the Washington Post. Jefferson Keel is the president of the National Congress of American Indians, and the opinion piece is titled, "Here's Something I'd Be Thankful For, Ridding Football of Racial Slurs." So he's obviously discussing Thanksgiving, and Thanksgiving in the NFL, they do a big promotion of the festivities, and they're usually games early Sunday afternoon, early Thursday afternoon, Thursday, then evening Thursday to celebrate Thanksgiving. And what better way of celebrating Thanksgiving by having one of the 32 teams have a racial slur? So Jefferson Keel explains that 50 years ago, the National Congress of American Indians, a national governing body formed to express Indian country's unified will, took a groundbreaking step to foster a better understanding of how disparaging words and symbols dehumanize Native people. Through resolution, it launched a formal campaign to teach the public about how Native-themed names and mascots harm Native people socially, psychologically, and academically, and to eradicate those names and mascots from the sports landscape once and for all. Since then, the NCAI, National Congress of American Indians, tribal nations, and thousands of partners have succeeded in eliminating more than two-thirds of these mascots from all sports at all levels. In January, in a watershed moment, Major League Baseball announced that its Cleveland franchise would retire its grotesque Chief Wahoo caricature. And this month, students at one of Canada's most prestigious universities, McGill, overwhelmingly voted to replace the university's Redmen mascot. So what they're referring to there is, if you were following Canadian news lately, at McGill, they had a referendum on replacing the Redmen mascot. It's not necessarily explicitly said that it's racism towards Indigenous people, but you can kind of infer it, because referring to Indigenous people as having red skin, or the slur red skin itself, is very common. So any kind of allusion to that, in my opinion, should be, and especially rooted in two settler colonial nations, that should be noted, because Canada and the United States, as we've discussed on the show multiple times, is on stolen land from Indigenous people, where a genocide has been committed and is still committed to this day. So just to have some kind of self-awareness, some kind of just general understanding of Canadian and American history, North American history in general, and understanding where our wealth and our society comes from, which is really the Indigenous land that we've stolen. So it's great to see Chief Wahoo go away as well. I don't know if anyone saw the Cleveland Indians. Yeah, that should go too, not just Chief Wahoo, their sick mascot that is a very stereotypical cartoonish drawing of an Indigenous person. But the fact they're even referred to as Indians at this point is just says how little people are willing to change, and just how slow society really moves when it comes to Indigenous people, which unfortunately are some of the most, if not the most, oppressed race in North America, due to their due to the need to continue to exterminate them just so we can scoop up more of their land. So the article goes on. Back to the article. Yet the R-word racial slur of the Washington football team remains an antiquated vestige of a less enlightened past, despite the team's desperate ploy to make its fans and Americans believe that the name somehow honors Native people. Nothing could be further from the truth. There is no honor in this slur, and history proves there never has been. As we have expected, this slur is about hate, making us feel less than and diminishing our rightful place as sovereign nations with the ability to control our own lives and futures. Consider its genocidal origins, epitomized in an 1863 newspaper, a Minnesota newspaper article promoting that state's policy to exterminate its native inhabitants. The state reward for dead Indians has increased to $200 for every redskin sent to purgatory. This sum is more than the dead bodies of all Indians east of the Red River are worth. So, wow, with that very explicit racism from not too long ago, you can see how little Americans care for indigenous folks and how little they value their lives and, you know, how highly they value their own over indigenous people, just to show that just that stark racism and the white supremacy that was in this moment in history. But that still continues today, that for whatever reason, indigenous people are worth less than whites. So that's white supremacy for you. Moving on, witness its adoption. Its adoption being the term redskin, by team owner George Preston Marshall, an avowed racist who fought fervently against integrating African-American players. Backed by white supremacists with slogans such as "Keep Redskins White," Marshall was ultimately forced to add African-American players to his team in 1962, 7 years after the rest of the league. Upon his death, his will mandated that none of his money be used for any purpose which supports or employs the principle of racial integration in any form. So if anyone was wondering the racist origins and the racist owners, because we'll get to talk about the current owner, Dan Snyder, if anyone was doubting how racist this whole saga has been with the Redskins, you can just look back at 1962, where they ironically are talking about keeping Redskins white. So a name, a racial slur towards indigenous people on an indigenous land. George Preston Marshall really wants to keep the team white and avoid black players on his team. So, and even up to his death, he was still a disgusting racist. So, you know, hopefully everyone realizes that his grave is a gender neutral bathroom. So if anyone wants to go visit that, feel free. Back to the article. Observe how it has long been used as a weapon of animosity and ridicule. We're referring to the term redskin again. In one of countless stories we have heard from Native people, National Museum of the American Indian director Kevin Gover recalls, growing up in Oklahoma, it was a racist taunt that was deployed against Indian kids like me and Indian adults for that matter. I don't feel honored by the word. Reasonable people open to learning these facts and stories recognize the need, as NAACP President Derek Johnson put it, to throw this dictionary-defined racial slur into the dustbin of history where it belongs. Reasonable people see the hypocrisy of the Washington team clutching to its mascot when the National Football League wouldn't dare name a new franchise the Blackskins, Yellowskins, or Brownskins to denote other people of color. Reasonable people understand that to reassociate the slur with Robert F. Kennedy by relocating the team's whole home field to the old RFK Stadium site next to a memorial in his name would desecrate Kennedy's legacy of racial justice that placed Native people at its core. Reasonable people get that it's about making a simple moral choice to be on the right side of history. So yeah, if anybody is reasonable, they will not support having a racial slur as a mascot. And the people who view it as like, oh, you know, I don't want to do this political correctness stuff. It's not political correctness. It's not calling people a name that's derogatory and hurts them. And I feel if that's too much for people to ask, like maybe they should just move on to like another society where we could, as adults, and just somewhat intelligent people realize the fact that, hey, this term is not only rooted in racism, but is used as a racial slur, and it makes the people who it's targeted at not feel comfortable in their own skin, which is not anywhere where we want to be in 2018. So just to finish off the article, we're going to discuss the current owner, Dan Snyder. So The article reads, "Yet current owner Daniel Snyder feels he shouldn't have to get it. He believes that his billionaire status and the popularity of the product he peddles absolves him from extending a modicum of respect to tribal nations and peoples. He is betting that through a few window dressing donations to tribal communities, coupled with annual exercises in disingenuous pageantry, such as this month's American Indige Heritage Month charade at FedEx Field, he can avoid doing what a growing number of Americans understand is the right thing to do. Tribal nations fight against these mascots because they demean us and dismiss us and dismiss the fact that we are still here. Despite everything done to us, the genocide that is ongoing, we have preserved more and more we are thriving. We are 6 million American indigenous people and 600 nations strong, and we are perfectly capable of telling our own stories of who we were and who we are today. We don't need others to tell the world about who they think we are through offensive mascots that do nothing but dishonor and misrepresent us. It's long past time for Snyder and the NFL to be reasonable and do the right thing. For that, Indian country would give thanks." So I feel like that's a beautiful summing up of this issue of having the Redskin mascot still exist to this day. I don't feel comfortable saying the word. I don't feel comfortable with the mascot. I think it's horrible and disgusting. It should go and should have been taken away a long time ago. But it just shows you how no matter how sick and depraved you are as a human being, and no matter how little you care about other people, you can still do whatever you want if you have $1 billion. And so that's Dan Snyder for you. He's a billionaire, so he can do whatever he wants, I guess. And it doesn't really matter to anybody other than people, other than indigenous folks, because everyone else just is throwing their hands up in the air, just calling this political correctness, which it obviously is further than just being polite. It's not calling people racial slurs. That's not political correctness. It's just unjust to use racially targeted slurs. So why we're talking about the Washington R words, not only is the name very racist and disturbing and should be talked about all the time until it goes away forever, but recently for our NFL fan listeners, the Washington R words lost two starting quarterbacks. So starting quarterback Alex Smith, he broke his leg in a really gruesome Joe Theismann-esque sack by J.J. Watt, so that he's done for the year. And then backup quarterback Colt McCoy also broke his leg. So now they're down to their quarterbacks they don't even have on the roster. So naturally, you know, oh, who's a free agent quarterback that could be signed? How about that guy that took the San Francisco 49ers to the Super Bowl? Yeah, how about that Colin Kaepernick guy? Oh, wait, nope, the NFL, and especially Daniel Snyder, the owner of the R-Words franchise, are far too ignorant and far too racist to even indulge in having a protester protesting anti-blackness in America possibly play quarterback for their team, even though they are a few wins away from possibly making the NFL playoffs, which spells big bucks for the business. So just me taking, you know, the capitalist logic to its logical conclusions that, you know, it would make sense to go out and get the best quarterback you possibly could so that your team could play more games and then make more money for the franchise and possibly win a chance at the Super Bowl. However, as we're going to discuss in this article by Stephen Ruiz from USA Today, that has not been the case. So the article title, we won't be able to get through all of it, and it's awesome because it has little clips of NFL action in it, so you can see how big of a lie Jay Gruden is spinning about Colin Kaepernick and the Washington franchise. The article title is "A Complete Debunking of Jay Gruden's Excuse for the R-Words Passing on Colin Kaepernick." So the article reads, "To replace the injured Colt McCoy, who replaced an injured Alex Smith, the R-Words are signing a mobile quarterback who has experience playing for Jim Harbaugh, just not the one many believe and is most qualified for the job. On the same day, Jay Gruden told the media Washington was not interested in Colin Kaepernick, the team signed journeyman backup Josh Johnson, who last attempted an NFL pass in 2011, to sit behind Mark Sanchez, giving the R-Words, who remain just one game out in the NFC East, a quarterback room that screams, we're giving up on this season." So Jay Gruden said that not a lot of time to get a brand new QB and a system installed and taught in a couple days. He's been talked about and discussed, but we'll probably go in a different direction. Gruden is saying that bringing in Kaepernick would force would force our words to install a new offense in a matter of days, and that's just not possible. That, admittedly, would make a ton of sense if Gruden's offense was not already very similar to the one Kaepernick ran in San Francisco under Jim Harbaugh. But the two offenses are actually very similar. Here's Jay's brother John saying as much back in 2008 after the Buccaneers drafted, wait for it, Josh Johnson, the quarterback they just signed as a backup, out of San Diego, where he played under Jim Harbaugh. This is from 2008 Bucks Nation. Josh has been running a system that is similar to ours, so I felt that the development process would actually be quicker. You see him having to make a lot of throws that you would have to make in our offense. Of course, Jay Gruden, the current coach of the Washington R-Words, cut his teeth as an NFL coach on John's staff in Tampa Bay. That's his brother, John Gruden. He has, by most accounts, run a similar offense to John Gruden throughout his career. The terminology is no doubt similar, if not outright the same. The terminology is generally the sharpest learning curve for a QB coming into a new scheme. The concepts are all pretty similar, just so all of our listeners know. There's not too much that hasn't been done under the football sun. Here's another Harbaugh confirming that the Gruden brothers are running the same scheme. First off, John Harbaugh, head coach of the Baltimore Ravens. First off, Jay's an excellent coach. It's a West Coast offense. I think the Grudens have their own patent on their own version of the West Coast offense because they built it so well. So Jay Gruden runs an offense like John Gruden's, according to John Harbaugh, and that offense, according to John Gruden, is very similar to Jim Harbaugh's, which Kaepernick ran in San Francisco after replacing Alex Smith. So talk about a convoluted mess, but basically this all has played out before, because in San Francisco during Colin Kaepernick's first stint at San Francisco, he started over Alex Smith. So it kind of just comes full circle here. And just to debunk further, because I really appreciate the hard work and analysis that was put into this. While discussing Kaepernick, Gruden also claimed that to best take advantage of the free agent quarterback's skill set, the R-Words would have to install new run concepts. In other words, they'd have to run more zone read. But Washington was already running a lot of option plays per ESPN. Only six teams had run more before Alex Smith's injury. So, not to get too bogged down in more football jargon, as much as I love it, I'm a leftist, I'm a football guy, so this is right up my alleyway, and I absolutely love covering the Colin Kaepernick NFL saga, just because it's so easy to cut through these millionaire coaches and players and pundits and all these people in the NFL, because what it shows us is that By having any kind of serious analysis, of concrete analysis of what's going on here, it becomes very obvious that the NFL is blackballing Colin Kaepernick, as we've said before on this show, and has been alleged by Colin Kaepernick himself. And if it isn't obvious to everybody else, it should be, considering that the logical step for the Washington R-Words was to sign Colin Kaepernick. However, obviously, due to his activism surrounding racism and police brutality in America, they want nothing to do with him, because guess what? Daniel Snyder donated to the Trump campaign in 2016, donated $1 million of his dollars to the Trump campaign. So if you wonder how racist Daniel Snyder is compared to the first owner, who is also a racist, they seem about the same. It seems that there's just something about being an owner of a team that has a racial slur in it that you just have to be a racist to keep that up. And so let it be no surprise that Daniel Snyder is a racist that is not only a terrible person, but also a terrible franchise owner. So I love football, but I hate the NFL, because you can't even watch this league anymore. I mean, like, come on, the teams aren't even trying to win because they want to prove a political point, ironically enough, that they complain about people like myself and other people who care about the fact that Colin Kaepernick is blackballed is bringing politics into the NFL. But they are the ones that can't even run their own teams without worrying too much about politics. So, I mean, if this isn't enough to show you that politics run the NFL, then just watch the war rally before the game, where they have all the planes fly over and they do a tongue path of George H.W. Bush. Thank goodness he's dead, everybody. Am I right? Am I right? So we're going to have to take a short break for commercials, but we'll be right back after that.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Snoop Dogg. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smokey every day. Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
What's up, everybody? We're back. So you're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and if anyone's been watching the news lately, I'm sure they've caught this story. So this is surrounding Meng Wanzhou, the daughter and CFO of Huawei, the telecommunications giant in China and one of the largest telecommunication companies in the world. So this has made headlines all over and has even caused the stock market to tumble. And we're still getting updates from this today. And the reason why this is so important is she is in prison here in Vancouver. So a basic rundown of the story. She was arrested at YVR Airport on her way to Mexico via Canada under I think the charge was fraud. We'll get back into the details, so we'll get you all the facts here. For fraud charges, because allegedly Huawei was selling technology or in general doing business with Iran, which would violate the U.S. sanctions on Iran. And we'll get more into that. That's the root cause that we'll get back to later, but we'll just inform everyone about the current updates because the story is unplaying in front of us right now in Vancouver. And we're making international headlines. So it's great that Vancouver can stay in the international spotlight by holding a political prisoner by the Canadian criminal justice system at the behest of the American federal government. So that's where we fit in. We are basically the 51st state of America. If anyone ever doubted for a second that Canada can exercise its own unilateral or even its own interests where the United States would disagree, you're wrong. I'm sorry. And I've seen a lot of comments saying that, oh, this is Trudeau basically doing what Trump wants and blah, 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 blah. Don't get me wrong. Yes, Trudeau is literally doing what Trump wants. However, it should be known that any Canadian politician of all stripes would have to bend to American will because, let's be honest here, we all know who is buttering Canada's bread. We all know what side of that bread is buttered. And if you don't fall in line with the United States, you will be punished, as we have seen by the Americans arresting the CFO of Huawei. So imagine what they would do to Canada if we stood up to the great Satan of the world, the United States of America. So we're reading from BBC News. The headline is Meng Wanzhou, Trump could intervene in case of Huawei executive. So Donald Trump says he could intervene in the case of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou if it helps to avoid a further decline in U.S. relations with China. Whatever's good for this country, I would do, the U.S. president said. Ms. Meng, the chief financial officer of the Chinese telecom giant, was granted bail on Tuesday by a Canadian court. She was arrested on the 1st of December and could be extradited to the U.S. to face fraud charges linked to the alleged violations of sanctions on Iran. Ms. Meng, 46, denies any wrongdoing and has said she will contest the allegations. She is the daughter of Huawei's founder, and her detention, which comes amid an increasingly acrimonious trade dispute between Washington and Beijing, has angered China and soured its relations with both Canada and the United States. In an interview with Reuters news agency on Tuesday, Mr. Trump said he would intervene in the U.S. Justice Department's case against Meng if it would serve national security interests or help achieve a trade deal with China. If I think it's good for what will be certainly the largest trade deal ever made, which is a very important thing, what's good for national security, I would certainly intervene if I thought it was necessary, he said. So there's a lot going on there. It's being framed as if Trump had little to do with with this. He knows very little. And he said that it's the U.S. Justice Department acting unilaterally. So obviously this is very dubious and, you know, silly to think that the, you know, the people pulling the strings behind this are dumbfounded. And it just shows you how the president really isn't the one pulling the strings here in this case, because, you know, there's largely been the quote unquote deep state conspiracy. It's not really a conspiracy, everybody. Basically, what the idea behind the deep state is that there are, you know, they're unelected bureaucrats, people who get appointed to posts or, you know, are work their way up through these agencies like the U.S. Justice Department, the FBI, the CIA, and the like, the Pentagon and the like, and that they're the real ones behind American foreign policy and American, you know, moves like this, like to arrest the CFO of Huawei. So, you know, that would be unthinkable. It's almost unthinkable to think that the president of the United States really doesn't know what's going on. But now that you realize it's Trump, that kind of makes a little bit more sense. And when you understand that there is, that there are competing interests in the nation and that there isn't just the executive branch making all the big decisions and that there is a group of permanent bureaucrats inside the CIA, FBI, U.S. State Department, Pentagon and the like that are really, you know, far too powerful, completely unaccountable, and can secretly pull these kinds of strings. So that's why that's troubling, and it is happening. And I hope that this kind of explains, you know, that was kind of just a hint, hint, nudge, nudge that there are things beyond the public purview. So in the courtroom, there was a bail for $10 million Canadian dollars. And so she's on bail right now. The Chinese reaction to this, which I think is probably where the real story is. And for context, the reason why these trade disputes turned into petty political battles, like arresting people, well, real, more like kidnapping and committing international crimes by arresting you know, capitalists from other countries. This is important to know because this is how world wars start. So if the United States continues along this path to act in a very selfish, in an arrogant fashion where it takes on other countries doing things like arresting people and, you know, tit for tat tariffs and sanctioning people. If they continue down this road, it will only anger the rest of the world to the point where they lash back out at the United States. So what could that mean? Well, it could mean a conflict somewhere in the world. So where that is going is where the conflict will happen, by my estimations, ties back into the place where, which is what started all this, which is the U.S.-Iran sanctions. So we'll get back to that. We're going to in a second, but we'll start with how China is reacting to this. So this is back to that BBC article. How has China reacted to Ms. Meng's arrest? China, which insists that Ms. Meng has not violated any laws, has had threatened severe consequences unless Canada released the Huawei executive. Vice Foreign Minister Li Yucheng earlier summoned both the U.S. and Canadian ambassadors and lodged a strong protest urging her release. The ministry described Ms. Meng's as extremely nasty. Separately on Tuesday, it emerged that a Canadian former diplomat had been detained in China. Michael Kovrig's current employer, the International Crisis Group, said it was working for his prompt release. There has been no official word from China about his whereabouts. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Canada was in direct contact with Chinese authorities concerning the case. Mr. Kovrig previously worked as a diplomat in Beijing, Hong Kong, and at the UN in New York. Canadian officials said there was no explicit indication of any link between Mr. Kovrig's reported detention and the arrest of Ms. Meng. So, breaking that down a little bit, Michael Kovrig, I apologize that you're caught up in this, but it's not going to do well for him because it seems that if Canada takes a prisoner, China will take a prisoner. And unfortunately, this is kind of unmasking the brutality that the world actually operates under and how civil society really works, but is generally done outside of the realm of international politics or just in general outside of the eyes of regular people like us following the news. So in reality, states really act in these really brutal fashions to get their way because the Chinese state really needs to protect its largest large companies like Huawei, because that is where China gets its power. And this is kind of a Marxist understanding of how international politics work, and basically saying that, you know, international power doesn't come from gunboat diplomacy or even your ability to execute a military operation. Where it really comes from is your ability to produce goods, because the production of goods basically underwrites our entire society. So using that kind of idea, it makes sense why this is capturing everybody's attention, because although military movements are very exciting and there's lots of weaponry involved, which everybody seems to really fetishize, this is really where I think that the rubber hits the road, and where it gets really tricky, and where the states are very interested in solving these problems, because, you know, Huawei is a billion-dollar telecommunications giant, so keeping its CFO out of Canadian and then American custody would be the Chinese state's top priority. So we alluded to earlier the root of this, which is the sanctions on Iran. So looking from just as a macro view of this whole idea of what's going on here, taking a step back, what I can discern is that, you know, Canada is acting completely at the behest of the American government. The American government is losing ground to China, the fastest growing economy. So in an attempt to, to twist the arm of China while they're losing ground in what really matters, which is in the production of goods, and why America is losing the battle of the production of goods is because the parasitic, non-productive sectors of their economy, which is banking, finance, and the like, they run the American economy rather than the Chinese economy, which is run by the Communist Party, which puts all of its stock into production, really following Marxist theory. It's obviously not a socialist state, as the working conditions for workers, which is what socialism is supposed to be premised upon, is they're really tossed to the wayside. If anyone's heard of Foxconn, the factories there have horrible conditions. So we're not really a socialist state. I'm sorry to all the people who are Chinese socialist supporters. However, they are also a world power that counterbalance the United States. So, I mean, it's nice to have the United States not be, you know, acting as the Team America World Police like they used to in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. However, now that they are threatened by China, they are acting out in these really bizarre but also dangerous ways, because, you know, it's until Archduke Franz Ferdinand gets assassinated by terrorists, and then next thing you know, boom, we have a world conflict on our hands. That is kind of like what I, you know, perceive this to be, as it's setting the stage for either Trump and the American state's way to bargain for a really good trade deal with China, or it's setting the stage for a global conflict, which will probably turn nuclear due to the fact that China and the United States all have nuclear weapons. So from the perspective of a worker, this is all very terrifying, and people should be very aware of what's going on, especially in how Canada is intersecting into all this, which is that they are powerless. So just so everybody knows, that's where we stand in the world as the 51st state of the United States of America. Now, to the root of where all this started, which was the U.S.-Iran sanctions. And this is important because there's been a long history of U.S.-Iranian, of a U.S.-Iran relationship. So I'll get into where it got really busy in 1953. So this is from The Guardian, and this was from August 19th, 2013. And this article explains kind of how we got to where we are today. So the headline is CIA admits role in 1953 Iranian coup. Declassified documents describe in detail how U.S. with British help engineered coup against Mohammad Mossadegh. The article reads, the CIA has publicly admitted for the first time that it was behind the notorious 1953 coup against Iran's democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. In documents that also show the British government tried to block the release of information about its own involvement in its overthrow. On the 60th anniversary of an event often invoked by Iranians as evidence of Western meddling, the U.S. National Security Archive at George Washington University published a series of declassified CIA documents. Quote, the military coup that overthrew Mossadegh and his National Front Cabinet was carried out under CIA directions as an act of U.S. foreign policy conceived and approved at the highest levels of government, unquote, reads a previously excised section of an internal CIA history titled The Battle for Iran. The documents published on the Archives website under Freedom of Information Laws describe in detail how the U.S., with British help, engineered the coup, codenamed TPAJAX by the CIA and Operation Boot by Britain's MI6. Britain, in particular Sir Anthony Eden, the Foreign Secretary, regarded Mossadegh as a serious threat to its strategic and economic interests after the Iranian leader nationalized the British Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, latterly known as BP. But the UK needed U.S. support. The Eisenhower administration in Washington was easily persuaded. So I'll stop it there. There's a lot more interesting details on Iranian history in this article. So as we can see, why the U.S. and Britain get involved in Middle Eastern countries, let it be no surprise, oil. So the Iranians democratically elect a socially minded, not explicitly socialist, but a person who saw that the British basically exploiting the oil in the region as a problem, and rather than give away the oil for nothing to the British so that British capitalists can make money, he, being Mohammad Mossadegh, figured that it'd be best to take the most valuable resource into the hands of the Iranian state. So this is not socialism. This is just merely him taking back their natural resources and giving it to the Iranian people and the Iranian state. So that's not, this is not a communist uprising threatening the United States. They merely just wanted to take advantage of their own natural resources on the world market. So, and of course, that's unacceptable to the British and the Americans. So they overthrew him. And why they overthrew him was because they had a nice little whipping boy in there. They had their own dictator. And basically, the point of having their own person in there was so that they could have their own person executing their own policies. So the policy that they needed was to have someone in there, not Ayatollah Khomeini, but the Shah. So the Shah regime was more or less an American-British puppet who committed gross human rights abuses but was a secular leader. So that appealed to Western, that allowed the West to turn a blind eye to the Middle East. And how that played out was basically that British and American oil companies got a great deal because they had their own guy on the inside making sure that he would act against the interests of the Iranian people and act in the interests of the West. Now, obviously, all these conflicts amongst other social conflicts that were going in, and I can't do Iranian history justice here, but it culminated into the Iranian Revolution, 1979, and what happened then was they overthrew the Shah and replaced him with the Ayatollah Khomeini. And since then, the U.S. and Iran have been arch enemies, mainly because Iran controls their own oil. So it has very little to do with the fact that, you know, whether or not the Shah or the Ayatollah were brutal to the people or dictators or all this kind of stuff. That doesn't really matter to the United States, because the United States currently supports 72% of the world's dictators. So dictatorships don't really matter to the United States, and never get tricked or gaslighted into thinking that anyone cares about that. What it's all about is strategic resources such as oil. So now, in 2018, the United States still trying to, still at odds with Iran, even though that they made diplomatic progress with the Iran nuclear deal, basically asking Iran to not have nuclear weapons to defend itself against the United States, which they obliged under the Obama administration. Now we flip to the Trump administration and John Bolton, the national security advisor, where Trump and Bolton are basically egging on Iran for war. So that's what the sanctions are for. That's what all this, all these arrogant remarks and all these moves like arresting the Huawei CFO are locked into, is war with Iran. So they're trying to push Iran to the brink so that Iran will turn itself will act out and lash back out at the United States, probably with the support of Russia and other strategic partners in the region, to attack the United States, or at least push back against this, against their aggression economically. And once again, trade wars, just like in World War One, can unfortunately turn into actual full-scale war. So that is the reason why we need to care, and that's the reason why, you know, we need to look away from, look beyond the United States and no longer be the 51st state of America, but really look out for the people of Canada who want, who do not want war, who do not want to be complicit in starting World War III, nor do we want war with Iran, nor do we want war with China. So everyone keep that in the back of your minds as the story unfolds, where I hope that this doesn't turn into anything larger than a trade dispute, and that, you know, the global economy can keep chugging along. But until then, it's not looking too good. So we're going to have to take a short break for commercials, and then we'll be right back.
So you're a member of CITR and Discorder, but are you a true friend?
Get a Friends of CITR and Discorder card for $20 for discounts around downtown at
Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium, Sakura's Classical Records, the Cinematheque, Vinyl Records, and the Fall Tattooing.
The Crane Library is looking for student volunteers to record textbooks for those who cannot use print at the university. If you are a UBC student who is computer literate with an ability to read university material aloud and you have a willingness to learn new techniques, we ask for a two-hour commitment once a week. For additional information and to set up an audition, call 604-822-6114 or email crane.volunteer@ubc.ca.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and we are now discussing the Yellow Vests. So this has been a pretty wild story coming straight out of France, the birthplace of the guillotine. Right now, there is civil unrest that was triggered, not caused by, but was the catalyst for this explosion of demonstrations, was the gas tax. So we're going to read from Consortium News tonight, and they have a really amazing piece on the nuances of this whole event. This event has, you know, captured not the mainstream media. I mean, I guess they're afraid of people seeing protesting working and getting people to not getting the workers getting their way for once in our society. So it's nice to see that. But if anyone ever doubted that protest works or doesn't work, oh yeah, it does. Which is why, if anyone's been seeing whatever sparse coverage of this, of these events unfolding, have been very negative by liberals and conservatives alike, because all people that find themselves on the capitalist spectrum would fear a proletarian movement, a worker-led movement, a people-led movement, the poor and the working class really creating their own political project that terrifies the crap out of them. So, which is why I'm all for it, because they should be scared, because they're in power, the capitalist ruling class, and they've been doing a terrible job. I mean, we're on the verge of climate catastrophe. We have 12 years. Probably less to turn that back. There's social inequality unseen since the medieval ages, where there's 8 people who have as much money as the bottom 3.5 billion. So that's crazy. And finally, there is a resurgence of Nazis. So the ruling class has done such a poor job that those three things are still continuing to this day. And quite frankly, it's time for them to go, because if this happened under their dictatorship, you know what? Why don't we have our own, where we, the workers, create our own society, which isn't as screwed up as this one. So reading from this article by Diane Johnstone of, she's situated in Paris. This is from Consortium News. The headline is Yellow Vests Rise Against Neoliberal King Macron. It starts, "For centuries, the left hoped popular movements would lead to changes for the better. Today, many leftists seem terrified of popular movements for change, convinced populism must lead to fascism, but it needn't so," says Diane Johnstone, the author. Every automobile in France is supposed to be equipped with a yellow vest. That is so that in case of accident or breakdown on the highway, the driver can put it on to ensure visibility and avoid getting run over. So the idea of wearing your yellow vest to demonstrate against unpopular government measures caught on quickly. The costume was at hand and didn't have to be provided by Soros for some more or less manufactured color revolution. The symbolism was fitting. In case of socioeconomic emergency, show that you don't want to be run over. As everybody knows, what set off the protest was yet another rise in gasoline taxes. So just for context, if American fuel prices are like $2.50 a gallon, so that's, you know, that's way better than Canadian. But for American to France conversion, it's like if Americans had to pay $6 a gallon for gas. So, you know, obviously America runs on gasoline, so you know there would be riots over there. And hence, and France, a lot of those people need cars to get to work. And it's not about them being anti-environmentalists. They just need to get from point A to point B and don't want to pay $6 a gallon for gas. So back to the article. But it was immediately clear that much more was involved. The gasoline tax was the last straw in a long series of measures favoring the rich at the expense of the majority of the population. That is why the movement achieved almost instant popularity and support. So the yellow vests held their first demonstrations on Saturday, November 17th, on the Champs-Élysées in Paris. It was totally unlike the unusual trade union demonstrations, well organized to march down the boulevard between the Place de la République and the Place de la Bastille, or the other way around, carrying banners and listening to speeches from leaders at the end. The Gilets Jaunes just came with no organization, no leaders to tell them where to go or to harangue the crowd. They were just there in the yellow vests, angry and ready to explain their anger to any sympathetic listener. Briefly, the message was this: we can't make ends meet. The cost of living keeps going up and our incomes keep going down. We just can't take it anymore. The government must stop, think, and change course. But so far, the reaction of the government was to send police to spray torrents of tear gas on the crowd, apparently to keep the people at distance from the nearby presidential residence, the Elysee Palace. President Macron was somewhere else, apparently considering himself above and beyond it all. But those who were listening could learn a lot about the state of France today, especially in the small towns and rural areas where many protesters came from. Things are much worse than officials and the media in Paris have let on. There were young women who were working 7 days a week and despaired of having enough money to feed and clothe their children. People were angry but ready to explain very clearly the economic issues. Colette, age 83, doesn't own a car, but explained to whoever would listen that the steep raise of gasoline prices would also hurt people who don't drive by affecting prices of food and other necessities. She had done the calculations and figured it would cost a retired person's 80 euros per month. Macron didn't run on the promise to freeze pensions, recalled a yellow vest, but that is what he has done, along with increasing solidarity taxes on pensioners. So that's just a quick rundown of what's going on. Getting back to the spraying torrents of tear gas on the crowd and the police and all that, the police in France might be more brutal and more disgusting than the police in North America. They're not necessarily targeting people of color as much because obviously there's more white people in Europe. However, three or four people are already dead. One of the people that are dead was an 80-year-old woman who was shot in the face with a tear gas canister. So that's how little the police care about the protesters. And what? And well, I mean, actually, I should backtrack. They do care. They're protecting and serving at their fullest capacity. So if you're ever wondering what protecting and serving was, that's basically is getting shot in the face by a tear gas canister. And this is, we're just talking about the person who died. There's hundreds of people that have been injured by these tear gassings and other police brutality. There's tons of videos, if you want to look out there, of cops just dragging away protesters and beating them. Then there's all the people who are going to suffer permanent damage from the tear gas, because tear gas does cause permanent damage. Tear gas was developed during World War I to flush out the soldiers who are fighting along the lines there. So it's not just this playful, like the cop, like, and I feel like it just must be the media representation of riots and cops and that they're just trying to disperse the riot. But like, the riot, as Martin Luther King Jr. explained, is the voice of the unheard. And these people are unheard, and no one cares about their problems because, you know, the neoliberal elites are too busy saying, hey, well, why don't you just go buy an electric car? And obviously, you know, I speak about climate catastrophe all the time. Of course I'd love to drive an electric car. Guess what? Completely unaffordable for people who work at a job. You know, the only way to really make that money to get an electric car is you got to be, you know, a capitalist parasite where you own some kind of business, and then you extract, you know, surplus value from your workers, or, you know, you're just born rich, and then you just have your mom and dad buy you your sweet electric car, and you drive around in your Patagonia jacket sneering at the poor people like myself who are just driving regular cars, thinking, oh, why do they not care? And obviously, this neoliberal thinking is what has brought us to this point where people pretend, and this is unfortunately, you know, the left's fault, really, because the left, after the failure of the labor movement in the pre-World War II time, the exclusion of labor in the 60s and all that, and just really focusing on social issues, really ignoring the class issues, which if you think about society, I mean, class is probably one of the more important ones. That complete removal of that has led to the point where people delusionally thought that things were getting better, when if you looked at any kind of economic report, things were getting far worse. Because although we are being nicer to, you know, to people, for a time there was a black president in the United States for two terms, but guess what? When people can't make ends meet, you know, surprise, surprise, tempers flare. Racial antagonisms that remained not dormant per se, but were not, you know, as explicit and as loud like Trump and other fascist candidates have done, that only can come back to the surface when people don't have enough. So when you have austerity measures, and what austerity is basically taking the costs of society, you know, the costs for social spending, for paying back debt interest and the like, and rather than taking it from the people who make the most money, who are the most economically powerful class, you take it from the people who have the least. So not only are these people that had very little to begin with have now even less, it is apparent that they can never work their way up through this, because if you're driving to and from work and it's costing you $6 a gallon for gas, and probably it'd be about like $8, you know, for 4 liters here, like, you know, we're freaking out over having $1.50 gas. Imagine having like $2.50 a liter of gas here. Oh my God, there would be riots, because, you know, then the capitalist neoliberal delusion of, you know, if you just work hard enough, you can make it too, becomes really stupid. And you sound even more insane saying it, because how are you supposed to make it when most of your money goes to paying for fuel? And it's not even the fuel, it's just paying taxes to the state that mismanaged the money that you gave them, because that is just how things work. And when you pull it all the way through and you thread the needle completely, it is getting more and more apparent to more and more people, which is good, that the system is totally broken, is completely unreformable, because this is the reform. This is how you keep capitalism going, is you keep, you know, forcing austerity, and you keep using violence, which is in the form of the police, to get people to deal with it. So take, for example, the gas tax, right? People don't want the gas tax. They get in the streets and they protest, and they exercise their right to protest, which is a right. Then the police show up and beat the crap out of them, because although they're upset, you shouldn't be upset, because, you know, we have batons and we're going to force you to subdue and deal with this austerity measure through force. So that is basically how capitalism is going to keep itself going. Obviously, all of us looking at videos or reading about this are completely disgusted, and realize that this, and also recognize that this cannot continue, because, you know, the oligarchs are going to scoop up all the money from the poor people. And what have they done with it since 2008, where the quantitative easing of the economy post crash of Lehman Brothers and all those other big banks was, unfortunately, yeah, you guessed it. And look around Vancouver. This is how this thing is all, you know, coming around internationally, and is all interlinked, is that a lot of that money, the trillions of dollars of free money that were printed and now need to be paid back with off the backs of the people was spent on luxury housing. You know, that was where a lot of the money came into it. And that's where a lot of those luxury developers and all the speculation on homes really kicked off, was after 2008. So our struggle with the people of France is closer than we'd like to admit. And the conditions that we live in Canada are getting to the point where it is going to start looking like that over here. The French people obviously have a long tradition of revolting. The French Revolution of 1789 was very violent. There was the terror after, and then the guillotine was invented to speed up the execution. So I don't like violence. Violence is not ideal. I mean, my ideal play would be Macron steps down. He says he disavows neoliberalism and he allows a socialist minded leader to take control of the country and really, you know, build up the workers rather than keep pandering to the billionaire class that have not only been in charge, but also reaping the benefits of the society for, you know, since the dawn of capitalism, and have completely blown it. They've completely screwed everything up and they're doing a terrible job, and the system's run itself to its end, and a new class of people need to take over. Will that come peacefully? Doubtful. I feel like, honestly, the people of France, the billionaire class of France, and honestly all over the world, will not give up their space at the top. They'd rather us die in climate catastrophe or kill each other or have the Nazis rise to power yet again, rather than give up their wealth. So as far as political projects go and ways to move forward, it seems as if neoliberalism and capitalism need to go, because people are only going to get more and more upset. People are only going to riot more and more and more. And the violence inflicted upon these people is only going to get greater. And then, so with my calculations is, you know, if one or two capitalists need to go, then is it better than having an 80-year-old woman shot in the face with a tear gas canister? I mean, there is violence everywhere all the time. There's the structural violence of keeping neoliberalism alive, which is beating the crap and killing protesters and, you know, forcing people to work long hours at unsafe job sites just so they can pay $6 a gallon for gasoline. That's where we're at. The good news is, though, as these protests have gone on, more and more has been conceded by the French state. So obviously the gas tax went bye-bye as soon as people got in the streets and fought against it, which is great. On top of that, Macron is offering to move up the minimum wage, you know, magically doing that. It's almost like he could have done it the whole time, but people needed to riot for it to happen. So, you know, as the words of Rage Against the Machine, let the riot be the rhyme of the unheard. You know, if you want something to go your way, you can't count on Parliament, because Parliament is owned by the rich people that are screwing us. We're going to have to go into the streets, and it's going to have to be all over the world. And that's the only way that this is going to come down. And if you know, you don't like that proposition, you know, you'd rather just sit at home and twiddle your thumbs. What's going to happen is what's happening in the United States. It's what's happening in Brazil. It's what's happening in Eastern European countries like Poland and Hungary, is that fascists will come and take that space. Because if people feel like they are disconnected from society, they know that they're dispossessed, they know that they have nothing going for them, they will go with whatever message is most appealing to them. That is why, as leftists, myself, I'm working on my own propaganda. We need to, and like-minded people need to, think of ways to bring people, rather than, you know, allow, just throw our hands up in the air and be like, oh, you know, there's some far-right people in the yellow vest movement, and these people are not environmentally minded, they don't want to do a carbon tax, blah, 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 blah. No, that's all trash. That's a horrible analysis. These people are begging for an answer. They're begging for a way out. As the left, we need to offer them an alternative. Are you tired of paying crazy taxes and supporting billionaires who do nothing? Let's remove the billionaires. Let us all have a society that is made for the workers, and we will use the state rather than to subsidize the richest people in society. We'll use it to subsidize average people in society, and, you know, give that side of the equation to people, because people right now are looking at the status quo, which is neoliberalism, or, you know, the fascist right, which is blaming everything on minorities. No, let's not allow them to punch down. Let's show up in force in numbers and tell these people that, you know, it's the people up there that are the problem. There's a lot less of them. There's a lot more of us. There's a lot less cops than there are of us. There's a lot less billionaires than there are of us. There's a lot less capitalists than there are of us. There's a lot less bureaucrats than there are of us. So if we, the people, can get it together and really have a coherent narrative for these people to understand and really reach out to fellow workers that are struggling, then we can have a shot at change. And that is what the Yellow Vest movement really excites me, at least, is that people have had enough and are looking for a new system. And we need to present that system as socialism. So that's all the time we have for tonight. If you want to hear more of the Spencer Lachey Show, check us out on Apple Podcasts. So I'm going to be signing off and listen to some more awesome music from CITR.
This band is really good, and I've been wanting to find out more about local music.
Yeah, I heard about it through CITR and Discorder.
What's that?
It's a radio station. You can review all the music that comes in and help out with touring bands or just do some data entry to get started in their music department.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you can just email volunteer@CITR.ca and they can help you get into the station or just come in whenever.
Well, I'll be there, so...
All right, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Stranded, the Australian-Canadian Music Show with your host, Matt. You can find us online at any time. AustranderRadio.com is our blog. It can t-